Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 5 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland and Labrador, and that means, what are we now? There are 5 hours, 9 p.m. British Summer Time, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. in Moscow, and the early hours of Saturday morning for our listeners in Asia and across the Pacific. And wherever you are, welcome to another of our live Clubland Q&As. We haven't done this in a long time because of lockdown and looting and all the other fun of recent months. And I tried, seems a while ago now, we tried to do an almost kind of sort of not quite live one, but it was dead. It was inert. It was stillborn. I'm ashamed to have my name on it. It was a stinkeroo of the first magnitude, had no narrative thrust, had none of the crackle that comes when you are walking on the high wire of live broadcasting. So even though it was only, you know, whatever it was, 55 and a half minutes behind as live, it was a dud. It was a stinker. So we don't want to do that again. We're going to go back to giving our live Clubland Q&As a go, and I hope you stick with us for it. I look forward to your questions. If you're a new member of the Mark Stein Club, do shoot us a question and I will try to get to it if you've just joined in recent days or in recent hours. Ben Poser writes, "Dear Mark, as the proverbial Ayatollah Khomeini feels when bereft of the most titillating members of his farmyard harem, we have all missed you and the Clubland Q&A." If you don't know what Ben is referring to about Ayatollah Khomeini's tastes in barnyard animals, see my piece. I think it's in my book Lights Out on the Shagged Sheep, which became a cause for some controversy thanks to some complete wanker of a so-called journalism professor up in Canada. The Shagged Sheep. And you'll get up to speed on all Ayatollah Khomeini's strictures in such matters. Basically, the upshot is you can have sex with your sheep, but you're not allowed to eat the sheep afterwards. So if you're thinking it's like a twofer, embrace me, my sweet embraceable you, and then it's going to be lamb cutlets for dinner. You can't do it. You got to have one or the other. Anyway, not only on this 9/11 have we obviously forgotten, says Ben, what cultural enrichment Islam ultimately has to offer us once Muhammad's street corner ravings are kept beside one's pillow reverently, but we have also decided, as Muhammad did, that art, period, is haram, forbidden. For instance, Schindler's List is haram, since the black and white film stock certainly isn't going to fill up the new Hollywood People's Central Committee's melanin quota. Do you think we'll be lucky if the end result is merely a romantic Sharia-compliant smooch flick featuring the dashing, sheep-shagging imam and his beloved bisexual she-sheep, as such romances become normalized within society? May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, sir. Ben Poser. Well, the issue, what is the issue with Hollywood? The issue is that basically, as I said with Tucker last night, I think creatively we're a dead society. Hollywood is already as woke can get. It's been woke for a long time. I remember when my kids were grade schoolers, and we used to go along to see these films like Ice Age, these animated features. And they were so boring because you'd be hit over the head with the, like Ice Age, there's a hairy mammoth and there's a saber-toothed tiger and there's something else. And the whole idea is that they're an alternative family. You know, they're not obviously not genetically connected, but they act. And you think, oh, God, okay, boring. But it's quite cute, so you watch it for a bit. And then they forgot to put the cute bits in and the funny bits in. It just became the boring message. Same thing with the superhero movies. The superhero X-Men are mutants, you know. They're mutants, so people fear them because they're different. You know, just like we fear people because they're different, because they're gay or they're transgender or give it, will you knock it off and just tell a bloody story semi-competently? So they've had this. We've had this for most of this century now, and it's killing Hollywood. That's why, again, as I said to Tucker, it's basically mid-20th century superheroes and middlebrow English literature keeping Hollywood afloat. And they keep trying to wreck those. The reason people like those guys is because they like what Stanley and Jack Kirby created in 1964, or if you're a DC Comics fan, you like Batman. They like what Bob Kane and Bill Finger created in 1938. And all the other stuff, you know, oh, we're going to make Green Arrow Hispanic, so we'll make Green Lantern gay, and all this, all that's just boring. People actually like them for the reasons that the both in the late 30s at DC and the early 60s at Marvel, the guys who created them did. And all the rest is just junk. And the fact is now they're actually determined to kill storytelling. This is exactly what we mocked the communists for 50 years until the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it's interesting how all the things they do, we do. I mentioned before Milan Kundera's great novel, The Joke, which I had cause to think of when I was sitting in court in the Robson Street Courthouse in Vancouver in British Columbia, listening to an expert witness flown in from Pennsylvania discourse on my jokes. And I was thinking, this is right out of Milan Kundera. In Milan Kundera's novel, The Joke, a guy makes one joke and his entire life is destroyed because it's a politically unsound joke. We have had since then, since I was in court, we have had, because Twitter wasn't really a thing then, social media wasn't really a thing. Now we have a thing where, like that poor woman in New York, she makes one tweet as she's getting on a plane to South Africa. By the time she gets off the plane in South Africa, her career's over, she's lost her job, she's hated around the planet. If she applies for another job, the only thing anybody knows about her is she told a politically unsound joke and so you shouldn't hire her. We've killed the joke. That's an incredible thing. Rush was talking about it earlier today. People don't want to be laughed at. And actually laughter, genuine, honest laughter, is a very healthy thing for society. It's actually one of the reasons why the English-speaking nations, both in the British Empire and in the United States in the 1930s, didn't fall for obvious rubbish like Nazism, because they weren't quite as plonkingly, they didn't come from quite as plonkingly humorless a culture. John Cleese said the other day, tell me a woke joke. He was on the BBC and he said, please tell me a woke joke. And if you're interested in the answer to that and you switch on Stephen Colbert or Trevor Noah, they don't do jokes anymore. It's actually incredible to me. It came up in the little bit of the back conversation over last night's Tucker. You know, these are shows that have huge writing staffs. They've got dozens of people who are paid to write jokes that make the host sound funny. And they don't actually do that. Instead, Trevor Noah, he seems a very pleasant fellow. He hasn't actually told a joke since he set foot on American soil. He used to be moderately funny when he was in London and in South Africa, mainly because he told a lot of anti-American jokes. And oddly enough, the minute he got a job in America, he cut those from his act. So he doesn't tell any jokes. He strikes the correct attitude, and you applaud yourself because you are virtuous enough to recognize that he's striking the correct attitude. Now we're moving on to the other arts about all this. And the reason I brought up that letter to Harper's that all the big shot writers like J.K. Rowling from Harry Potter and Margaret Atwood from The Handmaid's Tale and Salman Rushdie and Martin Amis and all the rest is because that letter was too little, too late. They're saying, first, there's all the genuflecting about what a monster Trump is. You know, oh, Trump the fascist, Trump this, age of Trumpism, Trumpy, 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 that they have to do just as a bit of throat clearing before they can raise the fact that they're nervous about cancel culture. And even though they did all the Trumpy, Trumpy, Trumpy throat clearing, they got clobbered anyway. And we're talking here, now you look at this, J.K. Rowling has virtually single-handedly kept what's left of bookstores around the world in business the last quarter century with Harry Potter. If there wasn't any J.K. Rowling, half these, the big box store, the Barnes and Nobles and up in Canada, the Chapters and Indigo and all the rest of it, and in Britain, the Waterstones, none of these places would exist. They'd be out of business. And so even the most successful, I think she's the richest, is she the richest woman on the planet? She's certainly in the top five. And even she, despite the fact that they're trying to kill her, has to tiptoe around the edge. And if I could say one thing about how things go in the next couple of months, because as I mentioned to Tucker, I know some of these people, and some of them actually were helpful and principled in my free speech battles in Canada a while back. And so I would, at a certain point, you've got to say, Joe, Peg, Salman, look, you know exactly what the threat to your livelihood is. And it isn't Trump being Trumpy. We get it. You don't like Trump. We get it. It's a snob thing. If Salman and Joe and Peg invite him to a nice literary dinner party in Hampstead, he's not going to know with the right cutlery to you. He's not going to have any amusing anecdotes. He doesn't read. But we get all that. We get all the snob stuff. But at some point, you've got to know that this kind of thing where they're presuming to tell you what fictional characters you're permitted to create, this, your entire, you know, you were, Margaret Atwood was smart enough to understand when they came after me that you could have no, in a general sense, you could have no writing if you weren't able to have freedom of expression. And that's, she doesn't like what I say. She doesn't like my opinions or the rest. We have mutual friends. Like the late, great George Jonas. But there's not, you know, Peggy Atwood is never, ever, ever going to be someone who enjoys reading me. That's fine. But the point I made back then is actually what's happening now. That if they presume to regulate what you can put in a book like America Alone, the idea that they'll stop at that and they won't soon after be coming and telling Margaret Atwood and Salman Rushdie and J.K. Rowling what kind of characters they're permitted. And this is why, as I said, this is why these people have got to be made to move faster. Because the J.K. Rowling is the richest novelist on the planet. Okay, well, this is actually a threat to truth in art. So you've got to, these people have, that's actually the biggest general lesson right now. People have to move. You don't have time to turn the liner slowly, leisurely over the next few years. It's all happening very fast. It's happening too fast. And so you need to get on with it if you're serious about saving what it is you do. Laura Rosen-Cohen of our Laura's Links feature says that she agrees wholeheartedly with your moratorium on 9/11 commemoration. Today is the 19th anniversary of September the 11th, 2001, and we always used to, because I found it for a while useful to actually recall the righteous anger of those first few days. But the fact is, the official commemorations have curdled into something limpid and passive, and we have completely lost the plot to the point that, in fact, we have dishonored the dead of 9/11. And so a couple of years ago, the final straw for me was Mad Dog Mattis. Mad Dog, who might as well be a violet-coloured, violet-dyed poodle for all his mad doggedness, when he actually had a complete squish evasiveness in the first 9/11 of the Trump administration. I thought, to hell with you, Mad Dog. You know, again, it's exactly the same thing as the J.K. Rowling thing. If we can't speak the truth about this, nothing matters. Because if we're just playing our part in the erection of official lies, then to hell with you. I want no part of it. I remember 9/11, the morning, very vividly, because I remember having the radio on when there was just this news flash about the first plane, and you assume it's a little twin prop or a glider that's gone awry. And I was then, you know, the other plane comes and you know something's happening. And by then I'd had all these phone calls from editors in London and Toronto saying, can you write a special piece? Can you do this, do that? And in one of those bizarre intersections of the profound and the trivial, I was having a sofa delivered that morning. And so the guys come in with the sofa and I've got the television on. And on the television, there are the two Twin Towers smoking on fire. And I turn around because one of the guys who's delivering the sofa wants me to tell him where to put it. Is this the right spot? Does he want me to move it? Want them to move it 3 inches this way or 2 inches that way? And so I turn around to bark some sofa instructions to the guy and then turn back to the TV. And the tower is gone. It was there a moment ago, and now it's gone. And I'm thinking, what just happened? And the sofa guy is still yapping about whether it should be this, or the, you know. And at that moment, you realize you've just come under a spectacularly, brilliantly pulled off assault, the most brilliant assault on American territory since Pearl Harbor. And at the same time now, almost immediately, not just on these anniversaries, but within a few weeks, you had this drippy Richard Clayderman piano music and messages about giving blood, but they're all over the drippy piano music and referencing the tragedy. And it wasn't a tragedy. It was an act of war, and in an act of war, you should destroy your enemies. And we've now just had actually another act of war on the world, which is China lying about this bloody stupid bastard disease of theirs, lying about it, the lies being amplified by their paid shill, that Dr. Tedros guy at the World Health Organization, to the point where it's 188 countries it's in. And there's only like 193 countries, so it's basically everywhere. Again, an act of war. An act of war that should be treated as such. And Laura Rosen-Cohen says she saw an article today in the news about how the trial of the 9/11 hijackers has been delayed again, now because of the coronavirus. Do you think anyone in America, up to President Trump, thinks that this is the way justice ought to work? Is it not rather a drawn-out travesty of 19 years of spitting on American graves by Americans? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the grotesque spectacle of delaying justice again because of the Chinese coronavirus. The Chinese communists are the reason we can't finally end the justice kabuki against the 9/11 terrorists. What are your thoughts? Well, at this stage, I don't really care. You know, what's going to happen? At some point, the big fat guy with the hairy back, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he's going to wind up in a courthouse and he might be sentenced to death. And then we'll begin the 10-year. It's not like in the good old days or like that guy who got sentenced to death via Zoom on Singapore, where the judge gets out the black cap and sticks it on top of his wig and says, I order that you be taken from here to a place of execution and hang by the neck until dead. When you're given a death sentence here, it's just the start of 10 years of stupid appeals. And so, you know, some of us are never going to live. Even if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed eventually dies by lethal injection, a lot of us are not going to live long enough to see that. So whether it's 19 years to get him into court or 29 years to get him into court or 39 years to shoot the juice to him is you can't insult to use Laura's phrase, you can't spit on American graves any more than the system already has. You know, the First World War lasted just over 4 years. The Second World War lasted 6 years. We're in a war now, and you can't hang a war criminal in 2 decades? Who cares? It's a joke. I forget how many years it is since I went to Gitmo. Maybe that was, what, 2005, 2006, somewhere around then. And they were all living the life then. They had all these psychiatrists examining them to see whether they were depressed. And I said, well, they're suicide bombers. By definition, they're suicidal, aren't they? And they said, oh, well, yes, that's a complicated... You know, it was already clear. As I always say, I was introduced to the head CIA guy, the head Army guy, the head Air Force guy, the head Navy guy, the head Marine guy. And then when we'd run out of those, I was introduced to the baklava pastry chef who'd been flown in to bake their get ready their post-Ramadan pastries for them. It was a joke then, and it's become a bigger joke now. And the two salient points here, Laura. First off, we're already lapsing into the same posture the COVID that we did in relation to 9/11, in that just as it's clear there's not going to be any serious confrontation of what we're really facing then, it's already clear there's not going to be any serious reckoning with China now, because actually we're just a sort of general wimp loser civilization, unfortunately. But it's also it's also the case that what we see now on the streets, virtue signaling until death, diversity unto death, all was present in 9/11. What's the big takeaway from 9/11? Is that afterwards, the Western world doubled the rate of Islamic immigration into the West. That's, so we thought, oh, it's not enough that we imported a few people who hate us. We need more people who hate us. Not everybody. But even if the percentage is 2%, if you double the rate of Islamic immigration, you're doubling the number of people who hate you, as we've seen in all these stupid cars riding up on sidewalks and mowing down people at Christmas markets. And then at the same time, we do this pointless dithering around. I'm an imperialist. I think the British Empire was one of the greatest things in human history. And I love it. And it was a civilizing mission. And it did great things almost, not everywhere, but it did great things. And don't, my fellow Irishman, don't you start at me, because that's a different thing. That's, as somebody pointed out when Ireland became a dominion in 1922, this isn't going to work because the Irish don't see themselves like the Australians and New Zealanders did, as a daughter of Mother England. They see themselves as one of the mother nations of Europe, the Irish. That's true. And that's why, you know, so let's set that aside. But basically, the British Empire was one of the great, great achievements of history. So I'm an imperialist. But this international policing for 20 years running around Helmand province, we're building schoolhouses in some of the most worthless, barren sods on the planet, while at the same time we're surrendering some of the most desirable real estate on the planet, like Sweden, like the south of France, like Germany. What's the point of, you know, spending 20 years fighting to a non-victory in Helmand province while automatically surrendering Nice and automatically surrendering Brussels and automatically surrendering Malmo in Sweden? It's completely pointless, completely stupid. Let's see, where are we going now? Oh, Jeff G says, a couple of weeks ago, Trump brought the United Arab Emirates and Israel together. Today, it's Israel and Bahrain. Despite moving closer and closer to peace in the Middle East, the left has now taken on the position that this is a bad thing. Do you think they can keep up this charade? Or possibly charade? I don't know if Jeff G is of the Britannic persuasion, so how he pronounces that word is a mystery to me, as I'm only seeing it in print. But Jeff, in case you haven't heard, the Kingdom of Bahrain and the State of Israel will be sending, I think, the Prime Minister and the King to Washington for a big peace deal signing. Peace is breaking out all over the Middle East. And we should mention, incidentally, that Trump has just got a second nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. He got the first one for the Israel-United Arab Emirates deal. He's got the second nomination for Serbia and Kosovo. And it's funny because actually one of the things that one of the raps again, if you remember now, the same people who are telling us that Trump didn't do enough in February about the COVID were the people who were telling us in February that the most important thing on the planet was some bloody stupid phone call to some guy in the Ukraine. And that's what they had to impeach him over. So in February, when it would have been quite nice to have had some sensible and considered deliberation about the COVID, instead the news media were just full. Do you remember these people? The Vindman, this Colonel Vindman, who is the greatest American patriot ever. And then we had these striped pants diplomats from Foggy Bottom, the guy with his bow tie worn to Persiflage Monteagle III or whatever he was called. He had his bow tie wound too tight. These guys were a joke. Their argument was basically that the foreign policy of the United States is impervious to the will of the people. So that although this is purportedly a self-governing republic and people vote for Party A over Party B, they vote to remove Party A from office and install Party B because they want a change of policy. And the whole argument of the professional diplomat class, these guys like Vindman, the guy with the bow tie wound too tight, Persiflage Monteagle III or whatever he was called, is that there is a permanent foreign policy that the will of the people cannot alter, no matter what they vote for. And actually changing foreign policy, not just in these endless unwon wars, but also in the broader situation in the Middle East and the Balkans and elsewhere, Trump has actually had a far more activist and effective foreign policy than the Obama-Biden administration ever had, or the Obama-Biden-Vindman-Persiflage-Monteagle-III administration ever had. So, in fact, Persiflage-Monteagle-III and these guys actually should get a rocket up their butts every now and then and be told, no, your way has failed. This is where I part company with Bill Kristol and Max Boot and the other people. Because I'm clear, I'm a 19th century imperialist. There's no takers for that in America. It's a great tragedy. It's not what Americans are. Don't have an imperialist bone in their body. And even in Britannic terms, with one or two exceptions, I'm like a century past my sell-by date. But whatever you think the alternative should be, it is clear that the uniparty consensus is actually a big flop that hasn't got anywhere. And Bill Kristol and Max Boot and Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio and this idea that, we haven't actually won any of the wars we've started in the last 20 years, but we'd still like to start a few more because sooner or later, we'll... It's like the old joke about the manufacturer who loses money on every product, but thinks he can make it up in bulk. That's what it is with American wars. Okay, we started war number one in Afghanistan. We haven't won that. We started war number two. Okay, Syria. That's gone nowhere. Libya. That's gone. But let's just start a few more, and eventually we'll make it up in bulk. That's what it is. Needs rethinking. Carolinian writes, is the US pinned in Afghanistan by the millions of refugees in waiting? Will not the you break it, you own it, you bought it principle apply to these collaborators? That's Colin Powell. It's whatever it is, Pottery Barn, I think. Colin Powell was the one. Colin Powell is full of great lines. Absolutely hopeless warmonger, but he's always got good lines. His thing, we do deserts, we don't do mountains. That was his justification for not intervening in Bosnia. As we've come to learn, the American military, the Pentagon, the general staff can't do deserts either. The thing about that, Carolinian, is one reason you know how it's going wrong is that basically for 20 years, Afghanistan has been under an American imperium. And yet I've never met more Afghans than I have since America started running the joint. In other words, ever since America took over there, bazillions of Afghans have fled all over the developed world. So I have cab drivers in London who are Afghans who fled Afghanistan. They stuck it out in Afghanistan under the Afghan monarchy. They stuck it out when the king was deposed by his cousin, awful man. They stuck it out when the Soviets landed. They stuck it out when the Taliban took over. And then suddenly the Americans go in with three cups of tea, building schoolhouses all over the place. And the Afghans go, oh, no, I could stick the Taliban. I could stick the Soviets. But now I am leaving. I'm going to see my cousin in Paris or Milwaukee. And I'm going to become a cab driver. So I think actually a lot of the millions of refugees in waiting thing, Carolinian, has already happened. I don't know whether you're, I take it that means you're a South Carolinian or a North Carolinian. I think South Carolina is the one that's still just about a red state, whereas North Carolina has become a swinger, as we say. Owen Morgan writes, to future historians, which will ultimately prove more destructive of Western societies, the Wu flu or the ease with which governments have awarded themselves emergency powers with the ability to bypass legislatures and invent laws on the hoof, or the enthusiasm among police to prosecute pseudo-laws against the law-abiding while ignoring violent breaking of long-established, properly enacted law by obviously criminal elements. Supplementary, all three of the above here to stay. I think all three are here to stay, actually, and I would say the latter two are going to be far more devastating in their implications. What the people have accepted during the last 6 months is astonishing. And the fact that they're accepting it in as a permanent feature of life, I'm a bit, I'm a bit more gloomy about this. It's just because it happens to be all the things I like doing that have been scuttled by the coronavirus that makes me particularly sad about this. But I do think we cannot have this. We cannot have a situation where the more real crime is ignored, the more looting is ignored, the more rioting and anarchy are ignored, and the more we just have stupider and stupider impositions on the citizenship. We always used to have that. I always used to just use the northern and southern borders. In the southern borders, any drug cartels, any sex trafficking of minors, if that's your business model, any jihadists coming in from that dodgy Latin American triangle, you can all just get your skiff, get over the Rio Grande, walk into America. On the northern border, if you go, if you're an American who goes and plays the bagpipe in a competition in Montreal or Nova Scotia, and you're bringing your bagpipe back, you'll be given the third degree when you come into the country and have to pay huge amounts of money. If you're like my kid and you're bringing a Kinder Egg in that you've purchased in Montreal, you'll be given a hard time. And all those Kinder Eggs, there's six federal agencies on the whole Kinder Egg. You know, it's been like that for a long time. It's rubbish. It's garbage. I wrote about it a decade ago. And nothing happened. And now we're actually seeing it. And just we got a letter that's a question that's related to this. John. Michael Trueblood. Yeah, this is the one I wanted to get to. The mob assaulting defenseless patio diners in Pittsburgh last week seemed a little Lord of the Flies-ish to me. The main reason we have police, I think, is so that we don't have to protect ourselves. Kind of like the reason we have a military. Not advocating violence, but it seems like that carry permit may become useful if the police are stepping down. And Drew Weber adds, Mark, Tucker's lead story last evening was the harassment of diners in Rochester and Pittsburgh. Similar events were discussed earlier this week on Fox. A frustrated panelist questioned what can be done with the premise that yelling was not violence.
Yeah,
yelling, you know, protests are given wide latitude under the First Amendment, much too wide. The people have a right to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. We must set clear lines on what peaceable assembly is and is not. Yes, to gather in public spaces, but no to blocking streets or trespassing on private property. Also, protests should be limited to petition the government. Protesters do not have the right to harass others who are minding their own business. If clear lines are not drawn, the broken windows rule applies and we get what we see today. Your thoughts? My big thought is I always quote Lord Moulton. I did in yesterday's show from 4.5 years ago. What matters is not the things you can't do in a civilized society. What matters is not the things you can't do and not the things you have to do, but what ought to be the 80 to 85% of stuff where it's self-policed. Normal social relations are mediated by the citizenry among themselves. So my problem, at the risk of offending Mark Levin fans, with the idea that everything has to be presented in constitutional legalistic terms, is that it's missing the basic bloody point here. You know, when you dine on a terrace in an American city, such as Rochester, does not strike me as a... I was there last year on the Dennis Miller tour, and it did not strike me particularly as a city that's terribly congenial to sidewalk cafes, chestnuts in blossom, as they say in April in Paris. In fact, I played the Kodak Center. That's about a 2,000-seat theater, lovely theater. And when we went to the theater to do the show, the car comes and picks you up at the hotel, drives down the street, and we see the big marquee for the theatre, and there's all these people lining up to get in and what have you. And we drive past that, and I'm thinking, where are we going? And the driver explains to me that to access the stage door of the Kodak Centre, you have to go 4 miles heading out of town and into the back of the abandoned Kodak processing plant, you know, where they used to make films. Film for Kodak cameras. Remember when camera take a photograph, you needed film, and then you needed to take it to a shop to get the film developed? And they used to do all that in Rochester, and now that all has all ceased, and that plant is closed. And so you go 4 miles down a road, and then you drive into this abandoned industrial wasteland and drive through what looks like the set for the next Mad Max movie for another 4 miles until you're back where you started, at the back of the building, the Kodak Center, for the stage door. And I was thinking, wow, this would be a great place to film the next Mad Max. I was just looking, it was fantastic, this dystopian, abandoned, post-industrial nightmare. And I didn't actually, I didn't foresee that a year later you wouldn't need to film Mad Max in the abandoned Kodak plant in Rochester, because they'd be doing it on the streets outside. And so if you're dining in Rochester and you're at a terrace, because you can't go inside, because everywhere, particularly New York State, they've got these rules about dining indoors. So there's a lot more terrace eating now, for as long as that can continue. Because believe me, it's no fun dining on the terrace in New Hampshire in February. So people are dining on the terrace, and all that protects you from the mob is that there's a little bit of railing, usually. Sometimes there's not even railing between your nice little cafe table and your bottle of wine and your tuna tartar and the striped sea bass or whatever you're having, and the mob on the other side who are fighting for racial justice. And we know it doesn't actually work like that. We know that what's keeping the mob from stealing, from just like as we've seen, from actually, as I think Tucker showed, just someone reaching across the table, taking the glass, the cocktail, whatever it was, the martini, the glass of wine, and drinking it. What's keeping that? It's not actually positions on the First Amendment or anything like that. It's not a law. It's a social norm. It's a classic Lord Moulton example of the realm of manners. And if you once you lose that, so the mob, it's like church break-ins. One of the great joys of my childhood, I just loved to like wander, because it was a good way if you wanted to pick up a bird and you didn't actually, you know, you didn't want to set her alarm bells ringing. So you say, why don't we just walk across the fields and go on a nice country walk? So you'd take a nice girl. I'm talking about when I was like 14 or 15 or whatever. So you'd like take a girl on a nice country walk, and somewhere in the middle of you'd come to a country churchyard in the middle of a field. And you think, oh, it'd be so nice just to go in and have a look at the church. And you could. The church would be open. There'd be nobody around, and you'd just walk in, because people understood that there was a line that was crossed when you trashed a church. Now all those churches are locked and with the protective stuff on the stained glass windows. And so it's nothing to do with laws, and it's something to do with razor wire, because you don't want to sit on a terrace behind razor wire when you're having the striped sea bass or whatever. It's a social norm. And the minute that social norm goes, so the minute you see on the television, if you're like these weird losers in the Black Lives Matter, and they see that they can just terrorize the diners, they'll want to terrorize them so more. So with respect, Drew, I don't think this is a First Amendment issue. This is a realm of manners thing. And in a sense, Michael is right. The only thing, once you've lost the social norm that there are people dining on the sidewalk and you don't go and get in their face, once you've lost that social norm, the only thing that will bring it back is a carry permit, so that if someone does want to reach over and take your glass of wine, you just stick something in their face that will deter them. And we know how this is going to go. We know we've now got the Jerry Falwell Jr. Police Department in all these cities. They like to stand in the corner and watch, and that's all they do. And it has become politically difficult for them, and you can give me all your back the blue stuff all you want, but the fact is these cities are now anarchic. You can't call 911. If there are police around, they are there to watch the guy drink your bottle of wine. It's not going to happen. So we've lost the social norms. And insofar as dining au terrasse will be maintained, it will be maintained by carry permits, as Michael suggests. And let's go to Jill in SoCal, Southern California. Appropriately for today, we used to do the thought question of what ethnicities would have been likely to do the let's roll thing in similar circumstances to Flight 93. It was always a very short list. Israelis, sure, maybe Aussies. Now I guess the Aussies have to be cancelled. Do we pencil in the French? Well, just to be clear about that, Jill, in the days after 9/11, there was like a little interregnum before the Department of Homeland Security, before you had to take off your shoes and your coat, shuffling shoeless like a great bovine herd while the TSA grope your genitalia. There was a little interregnum, and you'll recall the shoe bomber. The reason we take off our shoes, right, is because the shoe bomber boarded that flight in Paris. It was an Air France flight. I think it got diverted to Boston, but I don't believe Boston was its original destination. And so halfway across the Atlantic, the shoe bomber tries to light up his shoes. And it was French passengers who beat the crap out of him. Because in those days after 9/11, once people understood, you know, all the 1970s hijacking procedures had failed to work on September 11th. So people understood, okay, when you're up there, you're on your own. So somebody starts pulling something like this guy trying to light up his shoes on the Air France flight, and the Frenchies, the cheese-eating surrender monkeys, as Americans like to mock, the Frenchies beat the crap out of him. You don't have to be particularly... At that point, everyone was like, okay, everyone understood the reality. Now, Jill continues, if we're the let's roll country, why are so few people fighting back against the current smothering tyranny? Here in Southern California, there are a handful of churches that have defied the total ban on religious services, but they are few enough that the state and country can prosecute them, and they have. But why aren't all the churches doing it? And that would be the end of it. Why aren't all the restaurants and gyms and so on just saying, no, we're done with this? Yeah, it's exactly the case. We free speech guys have been here before. You know, as I said, God, what is it now, 15 years ago? The Danish cartoons. I was very proud that they basically, that you maybe there's a couple of others I'm missing out, but basically I thought after they'd threatened to kill the Danish cartoonists for those Muhammad cartoons, that those cartoons would be on the front of the Times of London and Le Monde and Die Welt and the Wall Street Journal and all the rest of it. No, they weren't. The only publications were Charlie Hebdo, who paid for it. They republished them a few days ago. They paid for it in blood. And my magazine at that point, started by Ezra Levant in Alberta, the Western Standard. And we were the only ones. And as I wrote at the time, you know, when they do these threats, you have to say, okay, we're all going to publish them because you can't kill us all. We have to spread the risk. That's Ian Hersey Alley's great line. We all have to share the risk. Now, this is particularly relevant to churches because it's staggering to me. You know, in post-Christian Europe, we understand that a lot of people don't go to church. And a lot of people now have these shared parishes. I'm thinking of Catholic Europe. It's kind of incredible. It would have stunned my mother, but where instead of a village priest, you now have nine villages sharing the priest. So the priest is only actually in your church, you know, once every couple of months. So when lockdown happens, it's kind of easy to forget that you just haven't had your once every 2 months church service in your particular little village. But Americans are supposed to be serious church attenders. You got all the evangelicals and all the other things they don't have in Europe. And it's extraordinary to me that, as you say, with so very few exceptions, most of these churches have gone along with it. And as you say, if they'd all actually said, well, no, you can't tell a free people they can't worship God in church meeting houses for 6 months, if they'd actually all said, no, so we're just going to all have to open up, and you're going to have a big enough SWAT team to come and close down all of us, and you're going to have enough county prosecutors to come and prosecute all of us because we're all going to open. That's what should have happened. And instead, it's just a few dissident churches. And in fact, this would have actually been a good moment for serious contemplation of the divine these last 6 months. Because it is profound, and people are lonely, and people are isolated, and a vigorous, meaningful church could have done something in that. I mean, you know, the American churches are not as bad as those idiots in the Church of England who have had nothing to say about God or Jesus, but have been happy to berate alleged infractions of the COVID lockdown by advisors to by advisors to Boris Johnson, like my old editor, Mary Wakefield's poor put-upon husband, who was attacked by, I think, at least three or four bishops. And this has been a complete failure of religion. And it's the most disturbing element of it. And you know, nobody wants to get out there on television and berate the millions of people who are watching. But in the end, the acceptance of things that now are completely disconnected from science have nothing. You know, we say, oh, we're going to follow the science, going to follow the science. Well, the Imperial College guy in London, he was all wrong. And anyway, he didn't follow the science. When it came to a conflict between following the science and following his penis and getting that mistress of his, the married woman who's in an open marriage and likes to bonk the Imperial College guy three times a week, when it was a choice between following the science or following his throbbing penis, he followed his penis. So this idea that there's a dispassionate science to follow is completely ridiculous about this. Janet Long says, here goes the broken record. I know that President Trump wants to focus on restoring order and the economy and hasn't touched on the southern border much, but it is to me still one of our biggest concerns, and all the more so as the opposing party is on board for opening it up as wide as they can get it. We are focused on the detrimental effects of the Green New Deal and taxes, etc., but not enough attention has been paid to exactly what hundreds of thousands of immigrants... Hey, good luck with that, Janet. It's millions. You've left off a couple of zeros on that thing. A large majority of them, traffickers, cartel and gang members, would mean to our country as a whole. The economic impact alone is frightening. I keep looking for someone to address this. How about you, Mark? I've never not addressed this. When President Trump came along, 3 weeks after he came down that escalator, I said he was the only one who'd introduced a real issue into the election, which was immigration, because he was the only one, he was the first one from either party to talk about immigration from the point of view of the people who are already here. All the time we talk about immigration, he just wants to show, you know, the whole Bush, George W. Bush thing, who's regarded as the new Hitler by the left, he was a complete sob sister on immigration. Oh, family values don't stop at the Rio Grande. No, they don't. What stops at the Rio Grande is the United States of America. And since nation states have been the organizing principle of the world since the Treaty of Westphalia, that's all we got. You give that up and there ain't no world. It's just, and that's what, in fact, significant members of the global community, such as the European Union and the Democrat Party and Justin Trudeau, have given up. No, in 2020, there is no need for mass immigration. No need whatsoever. It's of no benefit to anybody who's here. And who's going to pick the fruit? Well, actually, they're developing machines to do that. There's not going to be jobs for your kids. So why should you be worrying about jobs for somebody's kid on the other side of the planet? Now, why isn't President Trump? That's still that's the issue on which Trump was elected, because people made the connection between it all, between, well, wait a minute, why are we outsourcing all manufacturing to China, but at the same time we're importing millions of unskilled immigrants? That doesn't seem to make much sense. And why is it that my grandfather had a middle-class life working on the farm, and my father did very nicely working in the mill, but my daughter does the night shift at the Quickie Crap, and my son is on heroin? And those are the people who provided Trump's margin of victory. And it still gets the biggest reaction when he's allowed to appear in front of a crowd and he goes off on immigration. It still gets the biggest reaction. It's the bedrock issue. It's why he came down the escalator. Mexico's not sending us its best. And it's why he drew huge crowds. And it's why he forced all the sob-sister sentimentalists, the Jeb Bushes and the Marco Rubios, he yanked the rug out from under them on that. And then he got subverted. Why isn't he talking about it this time? Well, I think that's to do with the fact that his campaign's basically being run by Jared Kushner. And Jared belongs to that group of sophisticated metropolitans who think that all this talk about immigration is completely vulgar and you're best to ignore it. But if Trump loses in November, the Democrats will legalize a permanent majority as their citizens. And, you know, we talk about this, these states that used to be part of the rock-solid Republican coalition, the big L shape running down the Rockies and then hanging a left and going out to the Atlantic Ocean. So Western and the Rocky Mountain states and then the big South. And it's all been picked away. And so this cycle, Texas is a swing state. Oh, really? How did that happen? And it's interesting to me, Virginia, a lot of the fact that Virginia is basically a Democrat state now. But Virginia, that happened not just because of government workers spilling over from the Beltway, so it's a commuter area for big government, but also from the fact that a lot of those Virginia communities have been hollowed out by illegal immigration. So at that point, the Republican Party's done. So he should be talking about immigration. He should be. You know, we had a chance. I was on some. I was on Fox and Friends with Ainsley and Pete Hegseth and I think Griff Jenkins and my great compatriot Janice Dean, who's had a fairly rough 6 months. And we should all feel for Janice and the battle she's in with that corrupt Andrew Cuomo warehousing people in old folks' homes and killing them. But Pete at one point asked me for a big thought, and I said at that on that show that I thought what was interesting is we were getting the first serious realignment of left and right, really since the French Revolution. And one of the great things that happened was that we were coming to understand that all these people, fiscal conservative and social liberal. You remember those people? They used to be rather fashionable, people like Christy Whitman in New Jersey and Bill Weld in Massachusetts and whatever the guy's name was in New York State. These were the very fashionable people, Schwarzenegger in California. And of course, when you say fiscally conservative plus socially liberal, the net result of that is super liberal because all the social liberalism comes with a hell of a fiscal price tag. And we were actually getting the inverse of that in some of these new populist parties who were, in a sense, fiscally liberal, because when everybody's got massive multi-trillion dollar debts, who the hell cares about fiscal prudence? But culturally conservative. That's really what Marine Le Pen is. She's not interested in terribly interested in fiscally conservative issues. She's fiscally liberal, but culturally conservative. That's what a lot of these parties are. And it was a significant development because they understand, you know, in the end, that's the important thing. Even if you could say, oh, we need bus drivers, we need Uber drivers, we need factory workers. They said all this in Northern England in the 1950s and 60s. And then the people came, and oddly enough, a person, whoever he is, whether you import him from Somalia or Slovenia, doesn't think of himself as a bus driver as his core identity. And so the mills and the factories closed anyway, and all these people imported to be mill workers and factory workers stayed around. So the mills all shut, the factories all shut, but the mosques remained. Cultural conservatism, without it, there isn't any other kind of conservatism. That's where I stand on that, Janet. And I would like it if he'd talk more about it, but he ain't going to do it because Jared's running the campaign. Jared doesn't believe any of that stuff. Kerry Kerstetter says, your wanker cop reports make me sick. Have there been any cases where any of those overzealous law enforcement officers have been punished for their abuses of excessive power? Until that happens, there is little chance of other cops acting reasonably. No, not as far as I know. You know, we see with like the George Floyd thing, those guys were off the force immediately. But all you've had in both the UK and in Australia and elsewhere in Her Majesty's dominions is that occasionally you'll see an assistant deputy chief constable standing up and apologising for poor judgment on the part of the arresting officer berating some little old lady for sitting on a park bench or whatever. That's what happened to that one. Gabriel Garcia Moreno writes, thanks for the Q&A, the first since I've been a member. You've covered the authoritarian overreach in Victoria, Australia well, and it's so extreme as to render parody impossible. You really couldn't make it up. Have you been monitoring the situation here in Scotland, where our dear leader Ms. Sturgeon, whose nanny state appetite, previously whetted by an illegal state guardianship policy, is in overdose mode, positively reveling in wagging the maternal finger at her ungrateful subjects for technical infringements of her ridiculously prescriptive diktats. Do you agree that the wildly disproportionate response to coronavirus is the logical civilizational stop-off for wet liberal democracies in the West, not far from the terminus where the whole Ponzi scheme hits the buffers? That last bit is true. It is going to hit the buffers. No, none of these guys, whether you're talking about Scotland, whether you're talking about continental Europe, whether you're talking about Victoria, whether you're talking about Canada, have any plan for a post-COVID viability. In Canada, they just saw this thing this morning. A majority of Canadian restaurants and hotels, it said, will not survive the COVID and will not survive the sort of relaxing of COVID where you're allowed to have 25% lockdown. I was in an airport hotel on the other side of the world more or less just over a week ago, week and a half ago. Weirdest thing ever, you only allowed one person in the elevator at one time in this hotel. Big chain hotel, airport hotel, nothing particularly fancy, but nice chain hotel. And I was thinking, oh, I hope that doesn't get embarrassing. I didn't need to get embarrassed. There was only me and one other person in this hotel with like eight stories. Everything, we've unraveled the basis of our economy. People go to work in cities and they work in big office buildings. That's why we built those buildings. They have there's no reason for them to be there unless people work in offices. Oh, it doesn't matter now. People work at home. Oh, yeah. Oh, in that case, what about the sandwich shop? What about, to put it in terms of Gabrielle in Scotland, what about a pret-à-manger? Or a Costa Coffee? What about all those little places? All that depends on there being office buildings with people working in offices. And we've said, no, that's not off now. So we're doing this, and we did it just for a couple of weeks, and now we've done it for 6 months, and now we're talking about doing it into the middle of 2021. Because in a sense, if you were to come out of it cold, clean and say, okay, it's over, people would suddenly go, wow, everything's dead. And it's only by keeping it going as a sort of temporary thing that people sort of, you know, live with the possibility that there will be an end to it. But I must say, you know, I'll just make a general point, Gabriel. And by the way, I hope I've said it right. If you're a Gabriel or Gabrielle, either way, we welcome you to the club and we hope you'll chip in on our Clubland Q&As as they occur again. But you know, the Scots, this is so pathetic. The Scots have deathbed demography. So if they were going to become an independent nation, and that's why I'm always in favour of calling their bluff, you would be an old and decaying nation. You would be born as such. And when you think about the Scots, no race, I gave a great paean of praise to the British Empire, no race did more to build that empire than the Scots did. In my own country, in Canada, everything that works in Canada was basically built by Scotsmen. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about the Hudson's Bay Company or the Canadian Pacific Railroad or whatever it is, all built by Scotsmen. They're the great engineers of the British Empire, the great rubber planters of the British Empire. It doesn't matter where you go, Hong Kong, Malaya, all over the place. And to see Scotland and all these brilliant Scotsmen somewhere, if they still made television, they still made movies that didn't have to have 30% of the secondary cast as transgenders and Muslimas and whatever, somewhere there's a great film to be made about the Scottish diaspora. Meanwhile, in Scotland itself, ground zero, you've got a dead nation keeling over from fried Mars bars, demographic death spiral, no children, men in certain wards in Glasgow who have life expectancies comparable with the Central African Republic. It's truly a tragedy. We must have one more. We can't just end after all this time on. Oh, another new member, Douglas Neviera. I hope I pronounced it a bit like Riviera, and I hope that's how it is, Neviera. That's a great Cy Coleman song. The Riviera on every street, a gay casino. We should do a version of that just for you, Douglas. Douglas says, I'm a new member and I'm loving it so far. Highly recommend it to anyone on the edge of joining the club. Don't linger on the edge too long like Jerry Falwell Jr. Just plunge right in and participate. Mark, can you please comment on free speech in America, in particular on college campuses? Does this censorship of thought on college campuses come from a hatred of America and its values? If so, how could this trend be reversed? I believe the reversal of this trend is essential for the survival of the American nation. You cannot have a country if its citizenry dwells in self-hatred, hating the country and its history. Thank you and hope to hear a response. That's very true. If you hate your past, you have no future. And again, if you can make films on this subject, there's a great film to be made about these unhappy white people, unhappy young white women, which is unprecedented, young white women actually threatening these diners in Pittsburgh and Rochester, and these even more violent, anger-filled trans women. So you're just like strolling through the street when the rioting begins in Portland or whatever, and some psycho tranny comes charging out of the shadows at you and it slams you in the chest. And yes, it's a big part of it is the expansion of university and the college campuses, but it's spread way beyond that now. We used to just talk about the nuttiness. Jonah Goldberg, my former National Review colleague, used to do jokes about, you know, Canada is one big college campus. Well, right now, America is one big college campus because it's all spread out of the colleges, campuses. And people who laughed at it because it was just on college campus never seemed to occur to them that one day it might spread beyond. But it has. And the problem is there are no takers for free speech there. What there are, and this is a disaster because they're adding ever more subjects to it, what there are correct attitudes. So, like, you might be concerned about climate change, and you might think climate change is going to destroy the planet. So you might be in favor, as so many people are all over the world, of restricting access to the airwaves and to the newspapers for people who are so-called climate deniers. That's what large numbers of Americans and others are all in favor of, because the planet is going to fry, so climate deniers can't be permitted. There's only one right, in other words, there's only one correct view on climate, and you're in favor of that, so you let it go. And then time goes on, and suddenly, amazingly, there's only one correct answer on Islam. And there's only one correct answer on same-sex marriage. And there's only one correct answer on legalizing immigration. And before you know it, there is these little things that you thought of were just isolated exceptions to free speech have in fact replaced free speech. That's what's happened on every American college campus. And the best thing that could happen is that the economic devastation that has now been wrought actually totals about 90% of so-called American educational institutions. Because, as you know, I don't care for these A university should be a thing of distinction, so there shouldn't be a lot of them. The minute you have them, like in Burlington, Vermont, which is a town, insignificant town population-wise, and has sort of 8 higher education institutions. It's like Taco Bell or Payless Shoe Source. There's one every if you miss the turn for this one, there'll be one in another couple of hundred yards. And we've actually got to make a serious effort to roll back higher education and get people to be adults earlier. Because that's what a big... Why do we have immigrants to pick crops in fields? Because actually this generation doesn't do any physical labour. Because higher education is now so expensive. It's 60 grand a year. If you could make 60 grand a year tending bar or doing a bit of seasonal agricultural labour, you wouldn't need to go to college. So you can't work your way through college anymore. So as a result, these people don't work. So as a result, the leisurely varsity they're engaged in doesn't ask much of them, and it frees up lots of time for writing. It's all connected. It's all connected, this stuff. We didn't really get to a big finish there, but that's the best I can come up with. It's all connected. This has been our first Clubland Q&A as we emerge from COVID. And we will do another one soon. I'm going to be... What have we got this weekend? We got Kathy Shadle's movie column. I'm going to be here with a song of the week. And we have various other delights for you coming up in the week ahead. I hope you'll check them all out. I hope you'll... If you haven't yet seen me on Fox and Friends or on Tucker... or heard me on Rush, there's tons of great audio, video content at Stein Online, and I hope you'll check out some of it. Thank you so much. We've run a little bit longer, but that's because this is our first proper Clubland Q&A in quite a while. I'm great to be back. We will do it again soon.